I'd like to bring this meeting of House Health and Social Services together in order. And present are Representative Tarr, Representative Tarrico, Representative Wohl, and myself, Chair Seaton. Representative Vasquez is excused. At this time, I wanted to remind everybody to turn off or silence their cell phones. And also, questions will be addressed through the chair. Today we'll be hearing a presentation by Jeff Jesse with the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and we'll also hear from NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I wanted to mention that at 3:30, both Representative Stutes, when she arrives, I think, and myself are going to have to attend another meeting, and I'll pass the gavel to Representative Tarrico to chair the meeting at that time. And we will return as soon as we can. So with that, would you like to come forward? Is there anything else to come before the committee from committee members at this time? Good afternoon. Would you identify yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation? And thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Seaton, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. And I'll try to leave plenty of time for the next presenters. Feel free to ask questions as we go through the presentation if you want. Better to interrupt and have some conversation as we go.
And I'm going to interrupt you right now and recognize that Representative Stutes has joined us. Go ahead.
So just to give you a brief overview of who the trust beneficiaries are, there are people who experience mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and other substance-related disorders, Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and traumatic brain injury. And, of course, we don't just wait for people to become beneficiaries. Prevention is a big part of the work that the trust does in hopefully avoiding many of these conditions for Alaskans. The trust has established five focus areas, disability justice, which we'll talk a little bit more about as we go through the presentation, substance abuse prevention and treatment, beneficiary employment and engagement, workforce development, housing and long-term services and supports. Our current priorities coming into this session, one is to restore the homeless assistance program funding. We believe that was somewhat inadvertently taken out of the capital part of the mental health bill during the work in progress budget. So we've already talked to OMB. I think there will be some adjustments to the budget to look at those areas again. So, but that's very important because those homeless assistance program funds are the true safety net for people across the state that experience homelessness. Medicaid expansion and reform, and I say and reform because the trustees are convinced that if we don't do something to fundamentally alter the trajectory for the Medicaid program, it's not sustainable. And that's not in our beneficiaries' best interest. I mean, yeah, we might make it for a year, we might make it a couple, 3 years, but if the house of cards just keeps getting higher and higher, at some point, it collapses, and it'll take our beneficiaries with it, and we can't afford to do that. And so we are, we believe, as invested as you all are in seeing that the Medicaid program becomes sustainable. We believe that Medicaid expansion is one mechanism that can be used to be a catalyst for that reform, and so we're very supportive working with you and the administration on how Medicaid expansion can be implemented in a way that leads to a more sustainable budget over time. One thing I talked to Senate Finance at length about this morning, where we discussed the mental health bill and why do we have a mental health bill and what's in it and why is it there, is to really start to look at the budget in a broader context. In other words, not just look at each stovepipe department or program and say, gee, if this is going up, that's bad. If it's going down, that's good. For example, if you look at behavioral health, you go, well, okay, let's just look at the behavioral health program. Well, but if you don't look, and we'll see this in a minute, if you don't look at how the behavioral health program impacts recidivism, and you're trying to control your corrections budget, then you're not looking at the whole picture. So you've got to start looking at these budgets in conjunction with each other. This conversation happened last year, for example, in House Finance, when Representative Wilson expressed her concern that, you know, one of the problems is these departments don't work together enough. They're all kind of stovepipe. And I respectfully pointed out to her that that starts right in that room in the Finance Committee, because what the Finance Committee does is it takes the budget and it pulls it apart into these separate department budgets and sends a subcommittee chair and a subcommittee off to work on that department's budget, and then brings it back to be cobbled back together into a whole. And that is not particularly helpful if you're, say, the Department of Corrections, and you're trying to figure out how to control your population, and here you are realizing that for inmates to be successful when they leave, they need housing, employment, and support for recovery. Well, those services primarily come from places other than corrections. They come from AHFC, they come from the Department of Labor, and they come from Health and Social Services. So we're really encouraging folks to start looking at the budget as a whole rather than looking at these things as stovepipe type of programs.
And before we go any farther, I want to recognize that Representative Foster had joined us a few minutes ago. And we have a question from Representative Tarr, but before we go on much further, what I would like you to do is back up and explain to the committee, we have new members, how the Mental Trust Fund works.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, right now we're talking about all activities and programs, but how it's structured and how it works, and how it works with, and its independence or its relationship with the state legislature or the state of Alaska.
Okay.
So, but we'll get Representative Tarr's question first.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just on this point, we were just bringing, you know, this very thing just came up at Department of Corrections Budget Subcommittee the other day. For example, the 24/7 program is monitored by Department of Health and Social Services, but of course, the goal is that, you know, it keeps people from recidivating and keeps them out of jails. I have been throwing around this idea of an interagency working group as a way to kind of share some of that information. Do you know of a different model? I'm just trying to, like, put an infrastructure to the idea. What is a better model? Have you seen this done in the past? What you know, do you envision could work well to make sure that we are having more coordinated conversations?
Well, Representative Tarr, through the chair, actually some groups like that exist. There's the Criminal Justice Working Group, which is an administration-organized group that includes public safety, corrections, but also health and social services. The Department of Labor has been a big participant in that.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some of these interagency collaborative groups going on. Both the House and the Senate included intent language in the budget last year for a number of agencies to continue to work together and develop a recidivism reduction plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a pretty significant jump to light speed, because it not only included the usual suspects, the court system, public safety, corrections, but it also included AHFC, Department of Labor, Health and Social Services, and the Trust. So we're getting there. We're getting there.
Okay. Thank you.
So to back up, for those of you that are new to the Trust, in territorial days, anybody with a mental disability was convicted of a crime of being an insane person at large and sent to Morningside Hospital in Oregon. This was a huge problem around statehood, because the state was going to have to take over paying for Morningside, and not only did we not have any visible means of support, we didn't really like this system anyway. So eventually they passed the Mental Health Enabling Act, and it did three things. It provided money for our own mental hospital, which was the first wing of API, and bought a motel in Valdez for people with developmental disabilities. Now, why would we do that? Well, Governor Egan was from Valdez. I'll let you sort of figure that part out. And then there was some federal money that reduced over a number of years to help wean us off of the federal dole, and it created a 1 million acre land trust, similar to the university land trust and the school land trust, so that the state could generate additional revenue over time from this 1 million acres. Just a quick aside, it was originally supposed to be a 500,000 acre land trust. And when it got to a committee in the House of Representatives, a representative from Nebraska thought this was a terrible idea to give this land to the new state. And he said, well, if you're going to give away a bunch of land, you might as well give them 1 million acres. He thought it would kill the bill, but they did. So we ended up with a 1 million acre land trust. We selected some of the best land in the state, Homer Spit, Kenai River frontage, the Beluga coal fields, big timber in southeast. It was the most valuable land known at the time, but we didn't know about Prudhoe Bay, or we'd have a heck of a mental health program. Nonetheless, over the next 25 years, about half of that 1 million acres was taken out of the trust at less than market value. We gave the big trees to the bald eagles, Homer Spit got taken out, and eventually there was a giant lawsuit, which was finally settled in 1995, and what it did was recreate the mental health trust. We got back some substitute land, so we now have about 1 million acres again, which is developed by the Department of Natural Resources in an agency called the Trust Land Office. There was a cash endowment of $200 million that's now grown to over $500 million. And the most important thing we got was a board of trustees that could oversee the management of these assets and spend the revenue from those assets to improve the state's mental health program for all the populations that I mentioned earlier. And of course, one of the biggest things about that is the trustees can spend that money without a legislative appropriation. Now, most of the trust funds do come through state government because we're trying to create a comprehensive, integrated mental health program, not another separate sort of grant system out there. Nonetheless, the trustees do have a lot of autonomy over how they spend those funds, with the exception of the admin budget, which the legislature has to approve to prevent the bureaucracy, which I lead, from paying itself first. Because believe me, I can always come up with a reason why we need to spend more money. So, does that help?
That does. I think that there might be, when the budget comes through, there's a mental health trust budget, and can you explain the relationship of that budget as it goes through our process?
Yeah, there are three main budget bills, of course. There's the operating budget, the capital budget, and the mental health budget. And as I said before, the purpose behind there being a mental health bill is so that we look at the mental health program in aggregate as a whole, including the capital part, so that we can look at how the different parts of the budget interrelate and look for efficiencies and effectiveness changes that we can make to the system. So that budget comes through. You at the finance committees deconstruct that bill into its departmental components. You deal with each of those budgets separately, and then we put Humpty Dumpty back together again at the end. But there's more interest lately in starting to really look more closely at the mental health bill and how the pieces interrelate, particularly as you start looking at how you're going to build a sustainable budget. One way to look at the mental health trust is we are the venture capital for the state's mental health program. We spend about $25 million a year, and our job is to help you identify those efficiencies and effectiveness changes that you can make and that we can help you with in order to build a more robust and sustainable mental health program. Just to mention one program, we just finished Bring the Kids Home, which was an initiative that we partnered with you all over 7 years to reduce the number of kids sent out of state from 437 at a cost of over $45 million a year to 88 as of yesterday, with that money reinvested in in-state services. The trust spent about $16 million of our funds in helping to organize, start pilot projects, otherwise facilitate you reinvesting those outside dollars into in-state services.
Thank you. Don't see any further questions, so go ahead.
So, one of the things I was asked to cover today is prevention and early intervention. What is the trust perspective on those sorts of issues?
And before we go forward, Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry, I guess before we go forward, I do have a couple questions. How do you access these funds? What agencies do you go through? I know that from personal experience that people in rural Alaska, I mean, they're aware of this mental health trust fund, mm-hmm. but it doesn't seem that anybody knows how to access it or utilize the benefits of it. What is the route to the access of this?
Yeah, Representative, through the chair, a couple ways. One is, of course, as I said, about two-thirds of our funding comes through state government. So we would allocate money, say, to the Department of Health and Social Services for a program that then they would push the money out to grantees in the community. Okay, so for example, we have done startup funding for the Bethel Sobering Center to help them develop a sobering center for people that are inebriated on the streets of Bethel. We also have some individual grants that beneficiaries go through a provider and apply for grants up to $2,500 for things that would improve their quality of life. So pretty much anybody that goes to a trust provider would know that they have access to those funds. So there's a variety of ways that people access trust funds.
Follow up?
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you say you have to go through a trust provider. How do you determine who a trust provider is in order to access it?
Yeah, well, through the chair, if they receive a grant from the Division of Behavioral Health, if they receive a grant from the Division of Senior and Disability Services, all of those agencies are our partners in providing services directly to the beneficiaries.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You could have seen the quizzical look on my face, apparently. If they receive funds from these different things, who is they? Here, let me make it even a little more simple because that's the way I think sometimes. It's easier for me. I have a mental health issue. I don't have the dollars to go and see a private psychiatrist. I live in a rural area. Where would you suggest I go to be able to access this mental health trust for help?
Okay, let me see if I can get this. Remember that we are venture capital for the program, so we generally do not provide base funding to provider agencies. Okay, so we are usually part of their base operating budget. So if you're in a rural community and you have a mental health need, normally you would go to the regional health corporation. So if you were in Bethel, you would go to the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation. If you were in Kotzebue, you would go to Manelik. And those tribal organizations would provide services to you. Now, let's say you were in Kotzebue, or let's say Kiana, which is in the Kotzebue region, and you went to the local clinic, and you needed some, say, check-in with a psychiatrist through telemedicine. Well, that telemedicine program that Manelik operates was developed in part with trust funding. So we provided Manelik with some funding to help develop their telemedicine capacity so when someone in Kiana needs to talk to a psychiatrist, they have access to telemedicine. So that's how we would participate indirectly, I guess you would say, in helping someone in Kiana get mental health services. But we wouldn't pay for the psychiatrist, we wouldn't pay for the medication, but we would find ways of helping to create a more effective system for people to get care. And I'm happy to come and talk to you individually at length about how this all works.
One follow-up.
Representative
Stutes. I promise this will be my last one.
Representative Stutes, we're here to understand the system.
Well, and I'm having
how it works, and so I just want everybody to know that if they have questions, we hope that they will ask them here so that we can all gain the benefit of those questions and the understanding. So I don't want anybody to feel reluctant to ask questions. I mean, if we get into an argument, I'll cut that off. But if we are asking questions, that's what we're here for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. Twofold, I guess. What if I'm not eligible to go to a tribal clinic? You know, I'm just a local gal. I'm not eligible for any tribal benefits whatsoever. And then I guess insofar as telemed, that kind of sent a flag up for me, because when we had the telemed people here, I asked them specifically if they facilitated, once they did their assessment, if they facilitated connecting the person they did the assessment with to a guy that could help them. And the answer was no. So I'm still confused.
Well, Representative Susan, Chair, I don't know what to tell them, who they were or what they were saying, but I can tell you that nationally and in many places of Alaska, telepsychiatry is the number one use of telemedicine. People are often surprised by that. They think that telemedicine is sending x-rays to somebody to read the x-ray, that store and forward type. And of course, a lot of telemedicine is that. But again, the largest use is through telepsychiatry. And it's a huge advantage in terms of reaching out. In fact, one of our agencies in Anchorage, Alaska Child and Family, is now working with families in upper and lower Kalispell, providing ongoing family therapy and individual therapy to a family in that community through the telemedicine access they get through the school. So, you know, that's huge. Now, as to your first question, if you're not eligible for tribal services, some tribal agencies can serve you. You may have to pay. If they can't serve you, then you have to find either a private provider, and hopefully you have insurance. If you don't have insurance, then hopefully you're eligible for Medicaid. And if you're not eligible for Medicaid and you don't have insurance and you don't have any money, you're in big trouble. Well, I'm just being honest.
I understand totally.
You're going to have a hard time accessing services, and that's why we're talking about Medicaid expansion.
Gotcha. I appreciate it. Thank you for indulging me.
Reverend Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just one thing I think that might help in this conversation, can you just talk about some of the groups that you provide grants to that then are direct service providers?
Oh, absolutely, Representative Torr, through the chair. RuralCAP. Is an agency that we've done a lot of work with, Tanana Chiefs Conference, NAMI, Ionia. I mean, the list is, right now I think we have about 175 different grantees or grants. A couple of them may be with the same grantee, but there are a lot of agencies that get trust funds throughout the year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was just thinking, to Representative Stu's question, that's another way that individuals can access services by getting a referral to one of those agencies. And that's what I would be more familiar with, different because I'm in an urban area, but as people finding out and then being able to be one of the beneficiaries, but through a grant-funded program from mental health trust funds. Yeah,
that's correct. Representative Tyler, I'll just give you one more example. The tribal system has a network of community health aides. You guys have probably heard of that, community health aides. Well, then they started developing behavioral health aides to provide behavioral health services in rural clinics. They needed to develop a handbook, a training manual, and a handbook for those behavioral health aides. That's an expensive operation to build that complete handbook. The trust funded that. And the reason we funded that is because that enhances the system. And when that handbook's done, they have the value of using it, and we move on to the next project. So, back to prevention and early intervention. Yes?
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify, is this only through the tribal health network that that was your explanation to Representative...
Well, Representative Wall, through the chair, no. Okay. The behavioral health aid program is a tribal health system, but we don't only work with tribal health agencies.
That's what I thought.
Oh, no, not at all.
I didn't think so. Thank you.
Yeah. So what happens in early childhood can matter for a lifetime. Now, I think you have all had some presentations about adverse childhood experiences. Is this ringing a bell? So you kind of, I'm going to skip through a lot of this and get to some of the meat of this. We know about early experiences, how they can impact a child going forward. You've probably seen the pyramid, looking at how if you have these types of experiences, physical abuse and neglect, emotional abuse and neglect, sexual abuse, an alcohol or drug user in the household, an incarcerated household member, somebody who's chronically depressed, a mother who's treated violently, one or no parents, the more of those events that stack up in childhood, then the worse your outcomes are over time. Now, some of those are fairly obvious. Now, here's an odds ratio of attempting suicide correlated with these adverse childhood experiences. The thing that's always amazing to me about adverse childhood experiences is how consistently the pattern is followed. Whether you're talking about suicide or alcohol and drug use, in this case, substance abuse increases. What is perhaps even more amazing about the ACEs work is it's sort of a firm grasp of the obvious to say, well, yeah, if you have all these bad things happen, maybe you're more likely to self-medicate with alcohol. Mm-hmm. What's more surprising is how the correlation with things like heart disease and asthma and other physical ailments, that it's not immediately obvious how having a number of adverse childhood experiences would somehow make it more likely than you would have asthma or that you would have heart disease. But the correlation is consistent across not only behavioral health issues, but also across other health issues. Now, why do we talk about this? Because, again, you're looking at trying to control a budget. You're trying to build a sustainable budget. And so it's the old proverb of, well, okay, we can sit here and pull people out of the river as they float by, but at some point you go, well, we can't just keep doing this. Somebody has to go upstream and figure out how to keep them from falling in the first place. Now, the unfortunate thing is the attention to this tends to be more focused at times like this when the fiscal challenges are such that you really are struggling to figure out how you're going to build a sustainable budget. And then you start to realize, well, yeah, these earlier efforts would really pay off in the long run, but now you're struggling to come up with the money to invest in those very programs. And so one of the things that we look at is trying to say, okay, if we're going to invest in these prevention programs, then how do we determine what our best bang for the buck is? And I'm just going to go through a few of these here. For example, the Nurse Family Partnership for Low-Income Families. What you do is you identify at-risk families at the time the child is born at the hospital, and you hook them up with a nurse, and they go into the home and make sure that things get off to a really good start. Well, this is actually a pretty cost-effective program. And by the way, this information came from the Washington State Institute on Public Policy. And what they did is they looked at all these intervention strategies and did a meta-analysis of all the studies that had been done on each of these intervention strategies, and then not only looked at which ones were effective, but also looked at which ones were most cost-effective. And it shouldn't be a surprise that the early intervention and prevention programs are some of the best bang for the buck. And that is because if you can head off some of these problems at the front end, then you're not paying for them all the way down the road. So you can look at, in this case, for example, you'd spend about $9,800 on each of these families, but the benefit's about $26,000. Gee, that's a pretty good return on investment. 76% chance of having a good outcome. Early childhood education is even more strongly correlated with a cost-benefit analysis. So you can look at this kind of data as you try to put your budgets together. Juvenile offenders. Again, you can see how these different strategies work. Look at the one on the bottom, though. This is one of my personal favorites, is Scared Straight. A lot of people like Scared Straight. You know, you take kids that are getting in trouble, and you take them to jail, you take them to the prison, you walk them around, you say, if you keep doing what you're doing, this is where you're going to end up. doesn't work. In fact, it not only doesn't work, it's counterproductive. There's a 1% chance you're going to get any kind of positive outcome of that. Now, we can speculate why that is, but some of the speculation is, well, kids have some inherent fear of the unknown. Once you show them what it looks like, and they see their homies working out and hanging out, maybe jail isn't such a big deal anymore, and so maybe you're better off not telling them what it's going to look like. Another one of my personal favorites, which I don't have on here, is the DARE program. Anybody heard of the DARE program? That's in the schools. Everybody loves the DARE program. The police come in, police officers in their uniform, they come into the schools and they talk to third graders, fourth graders about the evils of drugs and alcohol and how they shouldn't do that stuff. Kids love it. Police love it. Teachers love it. Principals love it. Doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Well, we're not really sure, but we think that when those third graders get to be teenagers, and they aren't listening to their parents anymore, they aren't listening to what the police officer said in third grade anymore either. You know what works? Is bringing recovering teenage addicts into the classroom. That reaches these kids. Now you go tell your principal, hey, I think we need to get rid of the police officer, and we need to bring in some recovering teenage addicts with a lot of tattoos and stuff stuck through their ears and noses, because that's going to work. But look, you're trying to build a sustainable budget. You've got to decide, are you going to invest in things that feel good, that you think will be good, or are you going to invest in the things that actually get results? I mean, that's the challenge that you have. Recidivism is huge. Looking at long-term budget demands, if you don't do something to turn the curve on the corrections population, you are going to build another $300 million prison with a $50 million operating budget. That is no path to sustainability. Again, you can do the same analysis. You can look through all of the different strategies that have been tried in other places. You can look at the data. Those last two are a pretty good one to look at. Case management, if you use swift and certain graduated sanctions, is actually very effective and has a good return on investment. If you do the same case management, but you don't do swift and certain penalties, then you spend about as much money, but the effectiveness goes way down. Well, how does this translate into programs? Well, there's a program now called PACE, Probation or Accountability with Certain Enforcement, that now has been piloted in Alaska. We're going to expand that if you fund it. And what that does is, let's not wait for somebody on probation to do a series of little things that we don't catch them and do anything to them for. Let's wait until they do something really serious, and then we'll put them back in jail for a long time. That doesn't work. What does work is the first time they step out of line, you grab them and you give them a small but certain penalty. You know, 24 hours in jail. Not 6 months, but 24 hours in jail. That is very effective. So anyway, that's the gist of the presentation, is to basically demonstrate that you can bring the budget under control. You can invest smartly in these strategies. You just have to use the data, keep track of the data, and if the programs aren't doing what they said they were going to do, then you got to stop funding them and do something else.
Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I feel like you just gave a glowing endorsement of Aaron's Law, so I'm happy about that. That's a great prevention strategy. But I think one thing that you didn't say that helps understand the magnitude of the problem is just the last number I heard from the McDowell Group study is $1.3 billion a year is what the...
Representative Tarr, through the chair. Yeah, we had the McDowell Group look at the cost of alcohol to the state of Alaska. Just the cost of excessive use of alcohol to the state of Alaska, $1.2 billion. Now, that includes criminal justice costs, where a huge percentage of crime is alcohol fueled, Office of Children's Services, the court systems, public safety. Lost productivity is over $500 million by itself. Just to put that in perspective, in terms of your budget, it's a $1.2 billion cost. Or even if you want to back out the lost productivity, what's that, about a $700 million hit to the budget? And the alcohol industry pays about $40 million in taxes. So we're collecting $40 million in taxes to clean up a $700 million problem. And I'll tell you, if that was any other industry that was leaving a $700 million mess in the community, we wouldn't be saying, oh, don't worry, the state's going to take care of it.
Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These programs that look like they might be, your solutions sound a little counterintuitive, but you say they work. Do you have problems convincing people of that?
Representative Wolf, to the chair, not when you see the data. I mean, people can add, they can sort of look at the data, like, for example, when you talked about Housing First, which is housing people with chronic alcohol problems that are homeless, and people said at the beginning, you got to be kidding me, we're going to spend state money to house people so they can keep on drinking, are you crazy? Well, guess what? Homelessness is not cheap. Homelessness is very expensive to the budget. They get their health care through the emergency room, and you pay for that. They get picked up by the community service patrol. The police and fire departments are dealing with them. They're in the court system. There was an article years ago in the New Yorker called Million Dollar Murray. They followed a homeless guy in San Diego named Murray for a couple of years, and he cost $1 million to be homeless. And so when you house them, and their health improves, and they reduce their drinking, and they're not getting picked up on the street, the science is absolutely clear. That is a money maker, a money saver for the budget. And the way we've convinced people is, for example, on Housing First, we took a bunch of people, naysayers, conservative assemblymen from Anchorage, and we flew them down to Seattle, and we said, you talk, well, we found one conservative assembly person in Seattle. I think there's only two. And had that assembly person, talk to them, and they said the same thing. Yeah, when we first heard about this, we went, no way. But now we see how it works. And the businesses are happier because these people aren't going to the bathroom in their entryway, and, they're healthier, and it's more humane, and it's saving us money. So it's data. You got to look at the data.
Thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Are you involved in the development of the whatever programs are going to follow the appropriation that was made last year? I think it was $4 million kind of through the Fairview effort. And I just have lost track. I'm just wondering, it might be helpful if you have any info for the committee to update us on what's...
Yeah, Representative Tarr through the chair. Yeah, in fact, I think as we speak, there's a meeting going on between the Division of Behavioral Health and some of the Fairview community members. And one of the things that the Division of Behavioral Health is doing with that money is developing an assertive community treatment program. And what that is too often in the mental health program, what we do is we have people come in for their appointments, and then one day they don't come in. They don't show up. And then we go, oh, gee, they didn't show up. And so we just wait. And then they don't show up for their next appointment, and they don't show up for their next appointment, and we keep waiting, and then eventually they get arrested, they end up in API, and now we got a big problem on our hands. What assertive community treatment does is, well, you know what, the first time they miss an appointment, or if we know they're very fragile in the community, we need to go out there and assertively catch them, before they decompensate, and keep them in their housing, keep them stable in the community, and then we don't have to deal with them when they cycle through these other expensive systems. So that's one of the things they're doing with that funding.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments from the committee? Representative Stutes.
I'm back again.
Huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just alarms me a little bit because you said your comment was, well, if you're not eligible for native care and you don't have Medicaid and you don't have any money, well, then you're just out of luck. Well, aren't those the people that really need some of these benefits? And you're saying, oh, well.
Well, to the chair, absolutely. I mean, I'm not trying to make light of it or say that that's okay, but the fact is that's the system of health care that we have. If you're not insured and you don't have enough money to pay, and you're not eligible for tribal health care, and the public system doesn't have the capacity to serve you, you're going to have a lot of difficulty accessing services.
Representative Stoops.
Well, isn't that what this Mental Health Trust Fund is for? Or am I kind of confused about this? I mean, this is public, state-owned fund, I'm presuming. Maybe I'm even incorrect on that. So it would seem to me that there's got to be some avenue for these people who don't have Medicaid and don't have medical insurance and don't have money, have access to some kind of treatment.
Representative Seuss, through the chair, we would totally agree. The trust has roughly about $20 to $25 million a year to spend to help improve the program. Okay, the entire mental health program, if you include Medicaid, is well over $300 million. So even if we took every dollar we had and we put it into additional capacity in the service system, it would be a drop in the bucket, which is why we focus our dollars on figuring out a way to enhance the system overall so it can serve more people than we could possibly serve if we used our dollars directly. For example, that's why one of the things we're doing right now is trying to help with Medicaid expansion. We estimate just in behavioral health, 5,000 beneficiaries could become eligible for Medicaid. Under the expansion. We couldn't serve those 5,000 people if we spent all of our money on direct services. And if we did spend all of our money on direct services, two things. One is, it is possible that the legislature would just back out, say, $25 million of general funds, and we wouldn't have any more services, but all the trust money would be locked up in these ongoing services. Okay, that's the first problem. The second problem is you would no longer have any venture capital. And so when you thought mental health courts were a good idea and you wanted to pilot those, or when you wanted to look into housing first, you wouldn't have the mental health trust to come and support you in doing that. You know, you'd be on your own. And in the past, those sorts of venture capital dollars in any kind of public system of care are just not available. Occasionally you can get some foundation support for some initiatives like that, but you have this unique tool. Bring the Kids Home is a good example. If you didn't have the mental health trust there that could spend $16 million over 7 years and organize that effort and follow the data and make sure that worked, you'd still have 437 kids out of state. Well, actually, now you probably have 500 or 600. So, you know, we can't provide all those direct services to the people that need them, but what we can do is help you make decisions on how to invest so that we can serve those people, like, for example, Medicaid expansion.
Thank you. You made that much clearer for me.
Any other? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While you're on the hot seat here, just an emerging issue that I hadn't really heard about before this week was also the problem with individuals seeking behavioral health services through the emergency room, and how, you know, emergency rooms are basically not equipped for those services. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you have any comments, but that's just really, to me, sort of underscored the extent of the problem, because if that's the last place of resort, of course you're not going to get turned away. But if they, you know, the right kind of specialty, you know, trained personnel are not there, then that's not going to really get you where you need to go.
Yeah, Representative Tarr, through the chair, absolutely. And that's why, for example, when we rebuilt API a few years ago, the original plan was to build a 200 and some bed hospital. And we said, we don't want to do that. We don't want to build a giant mental hospital. What we want to do is provide more community-based care. So we developed a psychiatric emergency room at Providence Hospital. So now, for that emergency mental health care, you don't have to go to API, you can go to the psych ER. If you're in Juneau or Fairbanks, you can go to the local hospital, which has mental health units, and they send very few people to API because they have the local capacity to deal with psychiatric emergencies. Now, if you're in the Matsu Valley, where Mat-Su Regional has not developed that capacity, you find exactly what you're talking about is not only are you in the medical ER, which is not really equipped to deal with you, but if you need more care, they have to transport you all the way into Anchorage to get that care. So absolutely, this concept of emergency mental health care is a very important one.
Any other questions, comments from the committee? No? Thank you very much for the presentation. We'll take a brief at ease and allow the next presenters to set up.
All the meetings of the Health and Social Services Committee back in order at 3:51. And I would like to ask the presenters to please introduce themselves and their organization.
I'm Dove Gartenberg. I'm the executive director of NAMI Juneau, but I'm here representing NAMI Alaska.
I'm on the board of NAMI Juneau and also on the board of NAMI Alaska. I first spoke to the House HES Committee in 1976. I think that was the last time I was House HES. The committee has changed its name since then.
I'm Crystal Borland. I'm the incoming executive director of NAMI Juneau and also representing NAMI Alaska.
Well, thank you very much for being here today, and please begin your presentation.
Well, NAMI Alaska is a state organization of NAMI, National Alliance on Mental Illness. The NAMI organization has about 1,100 affiliates across the country.
NAMI Juneau in Alaska serves southeast. NAMI Anchorage serves the Anchorage area, NAMI Fairbanks, the Fairbanks area, and now there's a new affiliate in NAMI Barrow. At one point in Alaska, there were 11 affiliates. I'll go a little bit into the history of NAMI in Alaska. NAMI started in the late 70s, early 80s when deinstitutionalization occurred, the closing down of large mental hospitals. Parents found their children, adult children, returning home, and really all throughout the country organized these local groups to respond to the situation of having mentally ill children at home. And NAMI developed out of that as a grassroots national organization, and then developed a structure of state organizations with affiliates. Do you want to say something about the mission?
Just so you folks know, I believe Ms. Holloway is online as well, Shirley Holloway. So if you need her for a reference, please.
Holloway is the president of NAMI Alaska, and I'm going to yield to her. We're talking about what NAMI is.
Hello, am I online now?
You are, Ms. Holloway. If you could state your name for the record and continue on.
Well, thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to say my name is Shirley Holloway. The last name is Holloway. And I want to thank the House Health and Social Services Committee for giving NAMI this opportunity to present to you today. Some of you might remember me in a different capacity in my previous life in education, I would like to briefly share with you what brought me to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and I'll be very brief about that. About 4 years ago, December, my mentally ill daughter took her own life. And at that time, I contacted, I think, your previous speaker, Mr. Jeff Jesse, and said I'd met him off and on professionally over the years, and asked him about how I might do something different other than flowers for their organizations, and he introduced me to NAMI. So I called them, and I was just blown away by the fact that the day after this happened, NAMI representatives came to our home and took time to meet with my daughter's children and siblings and her father and I, and really gave us a level of support that was unbelievable, and to this day I am so grateful for. But I indicated to Francine Harbor, who is the CEO of NAMI Anchorage, that if there was anything I could do to ever help them, to let me know. And subsequently, I became the vice president of NAMI Anchorage, and then later the president of NAMI Alaska. My mission really is that NAMI provides a service to families that is not there through any other agency that I know of. We spent years with doctors, counselors, paraprofessionals, therapists, experts, and no one ever said to us, do you know there is a program that supports families who are living with an individual with mental illness? So my desire is that NAMI can be all over our state with trained people to support families, advocate for families, and that other families don't have to go through what we did. So I really will let the other folks present more about NAMI specific, but I wanted you to know that this is probably one of the most cost-effective programs you'll ever hear about, and that we know and understand the immense challenge that you're facing fiscally, and that we're here to help with a solution, not add to your problems. So I want to thank you for your time, and we'll turn it back to the people there face-to-face. And thank you again.
Thank you, Ms. Holloway. Please continue.
Sure, just quickly. For the record, I'm John Hartle. We were asked to state our names because there are two male voices on here. And like Dr. Holloway, I became involved with NAMI through a family member. When we're all family members, people that suffer from mental disabilities of one kind or another. And I would like to reiterate the point that she made of how cost-effective a program NAMI is. NAMI is partly funded by the trust through the work of Jeff Jesse, who just spoke. And what NAMI does is it teaches courses to mainly family members, and the courses are taught by volunteers, and the courses are free to the family members, and the materials in the courses are developed by NAMI nationally, which is a huge national organization, and it develops just terrific materials to teach family members about the course of treatment of mental illness, the medications, the symptoms, you know, what can be expected in terms of outcomes and so forth. And for me, it was like a life ring thrown to me in the middle of the sea. You know, my family member was in a crisis and I had no idea where to turn, and somebody basically made me go to NAMI, and I learned a lot from doing that. And then Dove solicited me to become a board member. I think that's a pretty common way that board members appear. We're really here just to give you a general idea of what NAMI is and what it does, and to, you know, show you the benefits of it and its cost effectiveness, because it's basically a statewide volunteer organization. We are seeking money. We've spoken to several members of the legislature to talk to them about money. I know this is the worst year in decades to be looking for money. We hope to be able to compete through RFP opportunity through the Division of Behavioral Health within the Department of Health and Social Services. Partly we're here to say that so that if you hear that happening, you can be supportive. Hopefully you will be supportive. One thing that NAMI that's unique about it is that it provides services and information to family members, whereas mental health providers, psychiatrists and doctors, in this day of HIPAA, they won't return my phone call, for example. My child is over 18, and their providers, in my personal opinion, are terrified of HIPAA. And so they literally will not return a phone call. My daughter was in the hospital. I went to the hospital, and they would not confirm or deny that she was 50 feet from where I was standing, and because she was a little bit over 18. And eventually a very nice nurse said, well, if I happen to see her, I'll see if she wants you on her contact list. and then my phone rang shortly thereafter. But the point is, services are needed for family members who then in turn provide support to their family members who are suffering from mental illness. It's all basically free, and it's all very, very effective in terms of providing better outcomes to the people all over the state suffering from mental illness. Thank you. Questions anytime. Interrupt, please.
Yeah, for the record, this is Crystal Borland. And just to give you an overview of some of our programs, and it is in your packet, this one right here kind of talks about what NAMI does nationally, and I can talk a little bit about what we do locally. But one of the classes, as John touched on, is Family to Family, and it's a 12-week course taught by peers, so taught by family members that also have a loved one living with mental illness. And the curriculum is nationally based. It's an evidence-based program, award-winning program, and it goes through a series of things touching on medications, touching on treatment options, different diagnosis of mental illness. It goes through coping strategies. It really shows a family how to communicate better and more effectively with their loved one, and really how to do self-care. And what we find with family to family is when those individuals are able to cope and communicate with their loved one, they're going to become better advocates as a family. And also in hope that then that keeps that person out of institutionalized care. When you have a support of your family and your community and you have the services that you need, that's going to keep you out of prisons, that's going to keep the person out of hospitals and emergency rooms, and overall it's going to save us all money. And so other programs that we have, one called NAMI Basics, which we're launching here in Juneau next week, is for parents and foster parents and family caregivers that have a child that might be experiencing some behavioral, emotional difficulties, possibly be diagnosed or potentially diagnosed with a mental illness, and really provides that connection and support and information to those family members. In addition, we have support groups, and so there's support groups that are for people living with mental illness, as well as support groups for the family members. A little more informal, they're ongoing, and they're there to provide that connection for those individuals that are dealing with some really challenging issues. So, thank you.
Let me just tie this together also with the previous presentation. This is Doug Gartenberg, the executive director of NAMI Juneau. So we're a peer support organization. We're not a direct service organization. As Jeff Jesse mentioned, we are a beneficiary. That is, some of us, some NAMIs are beneficiaries. NAMI Anchorage and NAMI Juneau continue to receive grants, although we also raise money from other sources. When state funding stopped, NAMI used to be state funded. At the height, there were 11 affiliates. When that funding ended, the trust stepped in to support NAMI Juneau and NAMI Anchorage. And we remained the strongest affiliates in the state because of that. But we do feel that much of the state is underserved, certainly the rural areas, and that a NAMI presence across the state has this early intervention possibility with the benefit of being a peer organization. So you have motivated individuals getting the word out, connecting with providers, connecting with leaders in their communities to make sure there's education and the sort of support in their local community. The reason we can't do that on our own is that our training standards are such. When we train someone to be a family-to-family teacher, that's a three-day training for a volunteer. They're presenting curriculum, they're presenting information about current science on mental illness. We are not just letting anyone present. We have to train people not only to present this information, but connect with the people who are coming to the class, recruit people, find out people who are struggling. So the peer support nature of our organization, which is our great strength and why we think essential part of the mental health picture, does require funding to do this training and to create affiliates in other areas. We cannot, at this point, expand NAMI with other affiliates. We don't have the resources. But the trust has told us that if we can work something out, either through grants through the state, they would work with the state to see that there's an expansion of this vital source. So coming back to early prevention, I agree with Jeff Jesse completely that the earliest we can intervene, the cost benefits for the state are enormous, and the benefits to the family are enormous. So just, I'll end on this one note, this call I got today. So we're starting this parent program for parents who have children and adolescents showing signs of what we call early onset mental illness, emotional behaviors, difficult behaviors, but not diagnosed yet. Some do have early diagnosis, but most don't. I happen to be a parent who had a child with presenting symptoms at 11. I had no idea what was going on, and it took us a number of years of tremendous effort to find out that eventually that he had a bipolar diagnosis. But a lot of these parents are in discovery as early as 3 or 4 or the teen years. So our program we're starting called NAMI Basics is for that purpose, for families to take 6 weeks. It's free. They really learn about signs, about treatment, about self-care, communication. So I get a call today from a local mother who says she has a child who's very sad and has requested to see a counselor, and she has no idea what's the right counselor and no idea what might be going on. Asks this, I just saw the NAMI Basics flyer. Would this be a class that could help me and my son? He says, absolutely. And we don't know what's going on. We're not going to give you a diagnosis, but you'll learn about early signs. You'll learn about how to choose a counselor. You'll learn about the services that are available. And she was so, I mean, just the relief in her voice that this resource existed. We know we made a difference just in that one phone call. So that's what we do. And we'll open now, unless there are any other comments. Shirley has another comment. We'll take questions.
Mm-hmm. Any questions or comments from the committee?
Well, this is Shirley, and I just want to thank you again for allowing us to do this. Many, in fact, I think almost all the states, but a couple, have NAMI is funded through state funding. And we would not have anything going if it weren't for the trust right now. And I have been out with my tin cup with all the organizations, and we have been able to raise some money for training. In the end of January, we were able to train 14 people from Barrow, Soldotna, Anchorage, Juneau, and
Fairbanks.
I'm forgetting one.
Fairbanks.
But at any rate, that has the potential then for those people to go back and provide that same level of support and training to the people in their communities. And what we're really trying to do is to reach out to all of the communities that we can. And just so you know, we are working with GCI and some other folks to look at how we might use online delivery so that we can do that as well and be more cost effective. So with that, I want to thank this committee for their time and their interest in what we're doing, and look forward to further conversations and, even under the circumstances, maybe some potential support for what we're trying to do. So again, thanks.
Thank you. Any committee questions or comments? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I just want to thank you. I'm sure everybody feels the same for the work that you do. It's so important in our communities, and doing it on a shoestring budget. so I know people will be thinking of that in these difficult times. We're especially appreciative of organizations that use the volunteer resources and maximize those community, community volunteers and that dedication. So thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much. We do appreciate you coming in and the work that you folks do and the work that you're planning on doing in the future, I think, is very important.
Thank you
so
very much.
We really do appreciate that, and we appreciate the presentation today. Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
I don't believe there's any more business before the committee, so we will adjourn at 4:10.